Chapter 19. ST, God Knows Where Along Finney Avenue, Seattle, Washington, USA. We had set off, the three of us, determined to find the others. The other Dennises and Cinnamons and STs. The survivors. Telephone poles lay collapsed on their sides in the middle of Finney Avenue, their wires twisted like discarded dental floss. An electronics repair shop had been ransacked and gutted, hit at one point by a hurricane of searching mofos. I told Dennis and Cinnamon to wait by the front of the shop as I hopped through its graveyard of smashed plastic, motherboards, televisions with busted faces, and snaking wires. Shelves had been ripped from the walls, now rife with beckoning black holes. A strange, hauntingly high-pitched song provided an eerie soundtrack. I set out to find where the music came from. A teeming mischief of rats and a clutter of spiders with hairy beaver-brown bodies had divided the shop into their respective territories. The spiders watched me near their precious nest, rearing onto their hind legs and hissing obscenities at me. The female one was particularly vicious, vowing that if I took one more step closer, she would bind, gag, and torture my entire family with her infrangible silks. The rats were quick to assess that I wasn't a threat, continuing with their avid grooming. They're massively anal about personal hygiene. While some convened for a meeting about plans to create a network of tunnels they were calling the real Seattle Underground. The eerie song turned out to be the symphony of rats filing down their ever-growing choppers on a hollow lead pipe, a wailing, sinister siren song that seemed perfect for the times we lived in. There were no cell phones. Cinnamon, Dennis, and I set back off down Finney Avenue. We came across a King 5 helicopter that had crashed on top of a silver Tesla, bisecting it. Its once sleek lines were now severed, jutting and sharp. Oily tire tracks, signs of panicked escape, zigzagged across Finney Avenue, now a phantom of its former self. Then we found a row of houses. The first was a towering brick Tudor home, its front yard choking on weeds, its arched entryway leading to a covered porch. I indulged in a fantasy, I just couldn't help myself, of wrapping my beak on the door. The door opens, and there stands a mofo with a straight back and clear eyes. "Are you all right?" they ask me, and then I tell them everything, and, nodding their head, they stroke the length of my feathers with a smooth finger while offering me a condolence Cheeto. The mofo with clear, bright eyes tells us everything is going to be okay, that there's a cure, that everything will go back to the way it was. Goodness, I'm devastatingly handsome, and would I like a croissant? I was still warm, glowing from the daydream, when I hopped up the steps and under the arched entryway. I thrust myself onto a porch bench, the wooden swinging kind, to peer in through the intact bay windows. The home looked unsullied, floor-to-ceiling library of undisturbed books, orca-black grand piano, a marble bust of an old white mofo. A wall-sized painting of two African female mofos laughing together, heads swathed in bright blue, red, and green wraps, their long necks dripping with gold, faced the front door. I hoped, a deep hope from the part of me that answers when I'm very still, that they were still out there, laughing together under an African sun. That they weren't just a gold-framed painting in a broken city. And then my eyes tracked along a Persian carpet, at the edge of which was a large beige lump. My heart plummeted. I could tell from the stillness of the scene, from the chest's lack of rise and fall, that the English Mastiff's heart no longer beat. This would be the picture in a lot of homes, I imagined, where the domestics couldn't get out, didn't have anyone to answer their desperate pleas. Dennis's with no STs. I started to move away from the front door, ready to find the next home, a small stone lodged in my throat. I hadn't noticed Dennis and Cinnamon come up the steps. They were side by side at the front door. Dennis dragged his pancake paws down the wood, Cinnamon pacing in tight circles by his side. "Look again," she was telling me. I hopped back onto the swinging bench and surveyed the scene again. This time, I caught the shining sets of eyes staring at me from underneath the grand piano. There were two other living beings in the Tudor house. Ignited with purpose, I fluttered back to Dennis and jumped onto his back. "Dennis, let's go," I told him. We had to act quickly. I couldn't tell what shape the cowering dogs were in, but the deceased English Mastiff told a story of starvation. I tried to think, where else would we find a phone? It had been such a trial to find the last one, only to have it pillaged by the sick mofo equivalent of the village people. There were more houses to our left, but how were we to get inside to find a phone if a phone was the very thing we needed to get inside? It felt like that whole chicken and egg conundrum that mofos are always squabbling about. Phones were now our highest currency, and it would take me time and mofo-like imagination to find one. "Let's go, Dennis. Cinnamon," I said, and with little scampering Cinnamon bringing up the caboose, we took off back up Finney Avenue, stopping before we reached the electronics repair shop. I jumped from Dennis and sidled up to the mangled mass of twisted metal that was left of the King 5 helicopter and the silver Tesla. I gingerly stepped between lumps of scorched metal, shredded bits of airbag, and masses of splintered glass. The Tesla's steering wheel was embedded in one of the chopper's seats, now lying in the middle of the road like a terrifying art installation on vehicle safety. Eventually, I found what I was looking for. I picked up a sheet of glass, approximately the size of a tablet screen, and gingerly waddled back to Dennis. The glass felt like Big Jim's framed photo of Tiffany S. that I once tried to jettison from the upstairs window, heavy and awkward to hold on to. It took the last of the aged bourbon butterscotch treat in me to flap back onto Dennis, glass sheet balanced in my beak. I laid the glass flat onto Dennis's back, but as soon as he started to walk, his lumbering sway made it slip. I barely caught it in my beak, settling for holding it, as uncomfortable as it was, partially propped up on Dennis's back. Dennis sat down abruptly, causing me and the glass sheet to slide down the length of him. I was pushed onto my back and pinned against the tarmac by the glass. "Caw! Help! I can't... stuck! Heavy! Fuck!" I squawked, trying to wriggle out from the hefty sheet. "God! Rah!" It wouldn't budge. This is it, I thought. This is where our beloved hero gets flower-pressed beneath glass for eternity like some sort of priceless sports collectible. "Dennis!" Dennis's enormous nose lingered above me, his breath clouding the glass with moisture. He stared at me blankly for a few moments. There was a subtle spark in his saggy eyes, a look of amusement. "Dennis, for the love of Tostitos, a little help?" He yawned. "Dennis, get this off me," I squawked, feeling like an unsold Barbie. A weight literally lifted from my chest. I struggled to my feet to see that Dennis had the glass between his jowls and was patiently waiting for me to hop back onto his back. He'd enjoyed the crap out of the whole scenario, that skittle-brained scoundrel. We walked back along Finney Avenue in a tender shuffle. Cinnamon scurried along next to us. She was a skittish little thing, tongue lapping the air like a tiny plumeria petal. Her scars did not line her body, but nevertheless showed in her darting eye movements the flinches that rippled under her fur. She was at all times ready to break into a run. Like Dennis, she wasn't much of a talker, and I didn't know how much of that had to do with what she'd been through. As we shuffled up to the overgrown primrose, lilac, and black beauty elderberry bushes that once framed and now were proliferating around the Tudor house, we encountered our next problem. Where to find a mofo? The unicorn and the biker had been too fast, once riled, and were now too far away. No sense to backtrack. This section of Finney Avenue was quiet and deserted. Fluttering to the ground with a body full of adrenaline and an injured wing was tricky. Much to my surprise, I was beginning to feel a microscopic fleck of empathy for penguins, finally understanding what it's like to essentially be a winged Mr. Magoo. But I wasn't going to let it get me down, no sir. Mofos didn't have wings, and they were the greatest creatures on Earth. After almost impaling myself on a crystalline edge, I helped Dennis gently lay the sheet down onto the tarmac and looked around. No sign of mofos. We would have to wander in search of them, but that meant carrying the awkward slice of glass with us, which slowed us down, made us incredibly vulnerable, and put us farther away from where we wanted to be. The Tudor house. I fluttered back onto Dennis's back and then noticed something. Cinnamon was trembling. A full body shake had her in its talons. She stared ahead across the street. Dennis, seeming to sense my intentions, plodded forward to where she was staring. Cinnamon did not follow. She stood on the tarmac, fear squeezing her throat. "What is it, Cinnamon?" I asked with a head cock.
"There. They're right there."
Her ginger fur was puffed. Across the street was another house, a Seattle four-square home festooned with sleeping Christmas lights. In the front yard, surrounded by an ambush of brambles, an inflatable Santa and his compressed reindeer team rippled at the mercy of the afternoon wind. The wind blew to a crescendo, tousling my feathers. I looked up at pregnant, darkening clouds that converged overhead. A syrupy smell of anticipation filled the air. The grass was anxiously awaiting the rain, its thirst palpable. Dennis's careful lumber slowed. His head hung low, ears and facial folds flapping against the glass sheet as he inhaled clues to a world most of us will never know. He was taking us to the source of Cinnamon's tremors. He stopped as we neared the rusted green mailbox of the house before we'd reached the trunk of a voluptuous pin oak tree. Slow as a snail's silver, he raised his nose and the glass sheet in line with the oak. My face now numb from clenching my beak, I fluttered from his back and helped him gently prop the glass against the curb. A sharp blast of wind lifted me off my feet. I flapped hard to lower back to the tarmac, a jolt of pain streaking up my wing. The ringing quiet of it all bothered me. It wasn't good that I couldn't even hear the boil-brained twits of Aura squabbling and gloating about their sexual capabilities. A few steps took me underneath the gigantic pin oak that draped me in shadow with its plethoric dressing of leaves. Not being able to see the sky summoned winter to my veins. Then I saw what made Cinnamon tremble. Above me, six legs dangled from separate branches. One owner of two legs was a geisha. The white paint of her face had mingled with blood, streaking her olive-green kimono in sickly pink. Her once impeccable ebony chignon and its decorative kanzashi now hung limp, strands like greasy eels. She had no eyes, just red-crusted empty holes. On the thick collar of the branch was another mofo dressed in frilly Victorian garb, ribcage suffocated by a corset billowing bloody fabric cascading from the branch. The third mofo wore a traditional Korean hanbok, once resplendent in crayon orange and pink, now speckled with moss and gelatinous lumps of mofo tissue. One of her arms hung by a few defiant strands of skin. Around her grimy neck hung a lanyard, an access card for Seattle historical costuming. Between the three mofos was a gaping tree hollow. The mofos were silent as midnight tombstones. They used their humped backs and unnatural elongated necks to stretch out and touch their skulls to a black object. Stuffed into the tree's cavernous hollow was one of those headsets you put on your eyes to transport you to another world. The three costumed mofos repeatedly leaned in, pressing their foreheads to the shiny black plastic. I stifled a cry of horror. Many months ago, I had sat in my cozy craftsman home as Big Jim lay gently marinating in Fireball whiskey and Ben and Jerry's, snoring like a DeWalt power saw. My heart soared. I loved this part of the day. I fluttered over to him, commandeering the remote and channel surfing for hours, absorbing the rich and nuanced history of mofos. I learned about the Maasai tribe of Africa with their elongated earlobes and ability to speak Ma, English, and Swahili. I learned of the Alaska Inuit, the Aikenhead clan, and the Kwakwaka'wakw tribe. How the young Brazilian Satare Mawe mofos dipped their hands into a woven basket of fire ants for 11 hours to show their bravery. I watched the porcelain politesse of a Japanese tea ceremony, the Icelandic celebration of Siomanadagur for the seafaring mofos, the monkey buffet festival of Thailand, and how young Greek mofos' teeth are thrown onto rooftops with an expectant wish. These were all ways to paint a life, customs to celebrate the phenomenal gift of living. I'd been so mesmerized, my heart as light as the barbs of a semi-plume, thinking of how a mofo was capable of carving out the world to be anything they wished. And here sat three representatives of mofo's rich history rotting in the boughs of an oak. I was witnessing the slow extermination of mofo history and culture, and it was absolutely devastating. But no damn time to wallow. I had to appreciate the opportunity presented, no matter how gory and tragic, how much a cesspool of heinous fuckery. This wasn't going to be easy. I shuffled back to Dennis and the glass, emitting a series of clicks to let Dennis know it was time. Grasping the crystalline sheet in my beak, I thrust myself onto Dennis's back, propping the sheet upright. Dennis made several careful paw placements to inch us forward until we were almost underneath the pin oak and the three sinister swaying dresses. I tilted the sheet to allow it to catch any light and, most importantly, attention. My heart thundered. Another cold snap puffed our fur and feathers. The mofos persisted with their disturbed undulating above our heads, focused on the headset. A nervous whistle freed itself from Dennis's nose. Readjusting my grip and the angle of the glass sheet, I projected a tiny light ray onto the oak tree. Lowering the glass, I navigated the little white ray, forcing it to dance up the tree and onto the soiled fabric of the kimono. Steady. The ray fluttered up the olive-green fabric, up its desecrated embroidered chrysanthemums, and on to the glaucous skin of the mofo's face. It lit up the vandalized holes of her eyes. Dennis flinched. She didn't move. I carefully flew the ray across the oak's branch and onto the face of the Victorian mofo. My breath hitched as the ray lit up her crimson eye. Dennis braced. I fluttered my wings, driving my claws into his back, holding on tight. And then nothing. The mofos didn't move. They weren't swayed by the light or the sheen of glass. Frustration billowed in my chest. Why weren't they interested in the glass? The movement? Why were the mofos all exhibiting such unpredictable behavior? Remembering that I promised myself not to focus on limitations, I set to thinking. An idea struck me, though I wasn't sure I could pull it off. But then I heard Big Jim's booming voice echoing through time. Big Jim would often channel the advice of superstar quarterback of his beloved Seattle Seahawks, Russell Wilson, long before he probably became hippo food. Always persevere, always have a great perspective, and always have a great purpose in your life. He would often follow this with another Russellism. Why not me? Buoyed by the good memories and positive words, I swallowed and silently repeated the mantra, "Why not me? I could do this." Flooding my mind with the memory of a sound, I opened my beak wide, and from deep down in my throat, I let out the noise. Against all odds, having never recreated it before, I did the world's most flawless rendition of an iPhone text message alert.
Ding, ding.
The mofos snapped their necks down toward us in unison. Four eyes and two red holes lasered in on us. Time evaporated. Suddenly, mofos were scampering across the oak branches, a heinous low whine piercing the air. "Let's go, Dennis!" I screeched, but Dennis had already taken off, dropping from the curb and onto the tarmac to cross Finney Avenue. Ahead, Cinnamon darted into an elderberry bush. The mofos were on all fours in a breakneck arachnid run, gaining on us by the second. They were faster, more agile than the other mofos, dresses ripping as they thundered across Finney Avenue. Dennis was in a panic, running for our lives, bouncing me up and down on his back. The glass started to slip, and I couldn't hold on with the jostling and bumping, but we were nearing the windows of the Tudor house, and I had to. My beak aching, Dennis shot up the stairs to the porch, the glass sheet slipping off his back. I held on tight, the weight of glass pulling me from Dennis. And suddenly, Dennis was running alongside the swinging porch, and I leapt into the air with the glass in my beak. The mofos jumped, hurling themselves into the air with me, horrible yellow and brown fingernails reaching out for me for what I was carrying. They burst through the bay windows, launching me into a meteor shower of glass. I hit the wooden floors, rolling into a series of tumbles. I lifted my wing to shield myself from the raining shards. Raising my beak, I found myself face to face with the mastiff's carcass, skin in deep valleys between its mountainous bones, its tongue spilled out onto the floor, a fate I didn't want to share. One sonorous bark from Dennis didn't need interpretation. He was telling me to get the hell out of there. I hobbled back toward the bay windows, fluttering over a sea of sparkling glass. Just then, two brown bodies hurtled past me, leaping to freedom through the gaping windows. Behind me, the three mofos were on all fours, their faces close to the ground. Horrible, wheezy, snuffing sounds choked the silence as they hunted, sniffing as if truffle hogs. The mofo in the hanbok had clambered to the lustrous piano and was smashing her face against its black lines. The Victorian mofo rose onto two legs, her head twisting 360 degrees in search of a screen. I didn't have long. Flapping hurt, but I was able to launch onto the windowsill and then tumble from the ledge onto the familiar fawn fur of Dennis's back. Cinnamon was practically Velcroed to his side. We took off, running as fast as we could from the ravaged Tudor house. And as we ran, passing neighboring shops, we saw the brown and white bodies of two dogs, German short-haired pointers, a strong-legged, agile hunting breed with a fighting chance at life, disappearing into the distance. They were alive and animated, running under a swirling gunmetal gray sky. Their paws kissed the tarmac as they ran. Sweat shimmered across the rippling muscles that would give them every chance at a future in their new territory. And suddenly, I was surrounded by life and vibrant color in the tickling laughter of the leaves, the viridescent hope of glistening grass blades, and an ashen sky that was ready to give birth. We weren't even pissed that they didn't stop to thank us. Chapter 20. ST, in front of some shady-ass townhouses, Seattle, Washington, USA. It was Cinnamon who stopped in front of the cluster of townhouses. She seemed to have embraced our mission, a light in those Hershey's Kiss eyes. I no longer saw their whites, the sparkling fear. Finding life and those who needed our help, I learned, was her great strength. Cinnamon had an innate sense for what was behind a locked door and a fortress of brick, seeming to know whenever someone was in need of rescue. Her vibrancy had returned, perhaps sparked by a sense of purpose, and Dennis and I got to see her in her full glory. A little dog who resembled a cute souffle but was fueled by a fiery passion.
"Here! In here!"
she said, darting around the ground floor window to a townhouse where a flower box hung, full of long-deceased petunias and pansies. Her quick, saucy steps and the sheen in her eyes told me we had work to do. "Do you think there's..." I let my question and the hope it held trail away. To feel hope for a healthy mofo meant to feel the heartache of disappointment. I had to stop doing it to myself. There was a small crack in the window ledge. I fluttered onto the window box, inhaling the ripe bouquet of rotting flowers to peer into the window. Inside was a humble home with country-style furnishings, cushions with embroidery about grandma being a badass, chicken decor, plaid for days, and a buttload of mason jars. I saw a rocking chair, but no sign of mofos. The beige carpet, however, was mottled with what looked like little black-and-white slugs, some shiny, wet, and slippery, some long dried up. I knew what it meant, and I searched for the culprit among the gingham, farm-inspired effluvia, and hanging wooden signs that said, "Trust me, you can dance. Vodka. And no bitchin' in my kitchen."
"Come out! Come out!"
barked Cinnamon. An agitated little puff of white, brown, and black burst into view, flittering around the periphery of the townhouse, its cage. I lodged my beak into the gap in the window, pushing hard, leveraging against the glass. Wood and beak fought against each other. I pushed harder. With a groan of protest, the gap in the window widened. The house sparrow, a saucy bird known for its mischief, undeniable ingenuity — they were the first of the feathered to start adorning their nests with cigarette butts to ward off insects — and synanthropic shadowing of mofos, shot out through the gap in the window. Cinnamon, energized by the victory, spun in circles.
"You're free, little bird! Free to fly again!"
she chimed, speaking from experience. She let out a tight yip, darting toward Dennis and engaging in the first play bow we'd seen. Dennis bowed back, and the pair chased one another across the tall grass in front of the townhouses, goofy faces stretched by smiles. Their spongy paw pads flashed into view as they pounded through the dandelions. The sparrow hovered, wings a beating blur as it addressed me.
"Thank you, thank you, thank you," cheeped the sparrow.
"Is there anyone else inside? Anyone living?" I asked, the hope of a live mofo tasting sour and decadent, like a stolen tart.
"Just me. Me and the insects I've been living on. I will never forget this, Blackwing. I'm indebted to you."
He was twitchy. Something inside him wound so tight it was ready to snap. I wondered how long he'd been trapped. Sparrows travel in vast quarrels, dependent on one another to stay out of the digestive systems of predators. Who doesn't find a sparrow to be a delicious hors d'oeuvre? They're like airborne pizza rolls. But sparrows don't do well alone. "We're trying to rescue the domestics, the survivors that are trapped in homes," I told him. The sparrow, treading air, darted its head to get a view of the bloodhound and the little ginger dog cavorting below.
"You'll want to go next door."
"What's next door?" But the sparrow, a bird with a thug reputation for the acts of violence they often commit against other feathereds, had vanished into the gray pall. I hopped to the neighboring townhouse's window. Cinnamon appeared by my side.
"He's right! You must look in here! This is the place!" she yipped.
This one had no window box for me to perch on. Dennis ambled underneath the ledge, and I gratefully scrambled onto his back to get a look. A gap in black curtains allowed me to see inside. The scene was bleak. In callous contrast to the country abode next door, this townhouse held dark secrets. Shredded newspaper, rusty hypodermic needles, and hoarder's squalor littered the floors. The walls bore holes and graffiti in dripping red ink that said, "We brought this on ourselves." Empty cereal boxes, broken plates, rogue bicycle wheels, weird white tubes, smeared brown shit, and spoons, and chaos. And hanging by a dirty rope necklace from the staircase railing, with a needle stuck in his arm, was a decomposing mofo. I gasped, instantly taken back to the day Big Jim and I went to his friend Pete's house for an intervention. Pete had succumbed to the needle, and Big Jim burst into his home like a hurricane, showing tough love with his angry words and eventually his fist. It hadn't worked. Pete chose the needles and the pills over friendship and eventually his heartbeat. Big Jim had swallowed back his tears at Pete's funeral, but I could see them brimming in his eyes, could hear the pain crystallizing in his barreled chest. Pills, needles, headsets that take you to other worlds? Perhaps it was something I would never understand about the mofos. If I had the good fortune to be born a mofo, I would spend every second of it wisely, enjoying my many talents and gifts. Why run away from perfection? From such immeasurable opportunity? A stockpile of food, cans of beans, peas, pumpkin, soup, cranberry sauce, and water, some punctured by tooth marks, were sequestered in a corner with a makeshift bed, a sort of paranoid cardboard fortress. On the wall, someone with great skill, the skill only a mofo could have, had made a black ink drawing of a bird rising above an evergreen. In its beak, the bird held an 8-pointed star. Next to the bird was a perfect mofo handprint. My skin rippled with bumps. The bird was a crow. And below that eerie drawing, writhing on a soiled shower curtain, was a litter of puppies. There were 5 of them. Thank goodness there weren't many more because of my shit counting skills. 4 black and white, 1 brown and white, sluggishly worming across the grimy plastic with newly opened eyes, some crusted over. Their mother, a skinny husky, stared through the walls to her coveted freedom with ice blue eyes. We had to get them out of there. The window was sealed shut. This would take another round of luring, another carefully executed liberation. Our murder would have to launch into action again, hot on the heels of the sparrow liberation success. I turned to find myself alone and whistled for my partners with a sharp shh. Dennis trotted across the grass, his sunken sad sap eyes watching me before lifting to the slate sky. Dennis knew a change in the weather was coming. Cinnamon had a delightful case of what Big Jim called going nuclear and was tearing around the stretch of tangled grass in wide circles, ginger hair streaming behind her, her tongue, a postage stamp in pink, tasting joy and an air thick with moisture.
"Free!" she hollered.
My bloodhound partner had already picked up the scent of the puppies and was at the front door, learning about the townhouse and its occupants through his olfactory bulb. I was contemplating our return to the chopper crash site to select another tablet-sized sheet of glass, already feeling fatigue in my bird bones, when Cinnamon let out a succession of alarm barks. Her panic, high-pitched hysteria was the soprano yip to Dennis's bass.
"Get back! 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 Back away!"
Cinnamon was crouching as she coughed out her barks, ginger fur standing on end. Dennis sniffed at the air, turning from the door to face Cinnamon. I followed Cinnamon's anguished gaze to several feet away from her, where a long-legged creature stood, dwarfing her. It was still, but for a slight wobble, a small, intermittent tremble that caused it to sway like a listing ship. Its eyes, wild and shiny with a forest fire behind them, were fixed on little Cinnamon. A wild dog that's supposed to roam the plains of sub-Saharan Africa, the African-painted dog looked out of place in Finney Ridge, with its satellite dish ears and its exotic coat, a patchwork quilt of mottled pigments. My intuition drummed SOS messages in Morse code. Aside from not belonging in our fine city, there was something else that was very, very wrong with this scenario. African-painted dogs are pack animals, strictly social, and this one was utterly alone. My hunch was confirmed as we watched the wild dog open its mouth. As if possessed, puppeteered by some invisible force, the dog's head was seized by convulsions. It twitched and shuddered for a few horrifying moments, releasing strings of frothy saliva from its gums. And then I knew exactly why this pack animal was alone. Shit! I launched into the air, ready to soar above and mob the wild dog from the air. 3 feet into my ascension, a streak of pain shot through my wing, sending me careening, a bumbling mass of black feathers, back to the front step of the filthy townhouse. I had forgotten my limitation, and I lay crumpled on the cement. But it was going to be all right. There were three of us and one of it, and it was sick and faulty, quivering in defectiveness. Think fast, ST. Think fast. What we needed was fire, or something sharp, a needle or a spear. I spun to face the trees around us, looking to their trunk bases for fallen branches, something I could wield in front of that wild dog to drive it away from Cinnamon. I hopped forward, announcing myself to the African-painted dog, and letting Cinnamon know we were there for her, because murders are forever, and what happens to one happens to all. I got 5 hops forward, vitriolic caws igniting in the air, when I felt a great force envelop my body. I flapped with everything I had, but I couldn't get away. Seconds were ticking by, seconds where Cinnamon needed us, and it took more seconds for me to connect the dots and realize what was happening. Dennis had clamped his jaw down on my good wing. I struggled to free myself, yelling at him, that scrotum-jowled buffoon, that we had to leap into action. "Dennis, get off!" Dennis, his mouth soft but firm, held on with a pressure that might as well have been an ocean current. I was an injured minnow, helpless against a great tide. The earth stopped spinning as the African-painted dog bared its long teeth, and in the middle of a fit of spasms, I swear it looked right into my eyes, right deep into the part of me that has never changed. And then I knew exactly who I was looking at. I had met the one who spits. And the one who spits was completely alone, packless, and without its murder. It was alone because it had rabies. We had run out of time. The one who spits released a surge of bubbling white foam, the spume of an insidious sickness, and then broke into a run, a twitchy mechanical charge hitched by ticks and those intermittent seizures. "Cinnamon, come!" I heard myself yell, channeling Big Jim in crisis mode, desperate Big Jim with rocks in his throat, as Dennis flew out of our Ravenna yard. The gate! Oh, God, Nargatha left the gate open, and Dennis galloped into the road.
Big Jim bellowing at the minivan that was going too fast, and we all screeched, mofo, crow, brakes, tires, and the van stopped right in front of Dennis's wrinkly face. Big Jim yelled at Dennis again, "Dennis, come!" in a stormy voice, nostrils flaring on his bar fight face. But when Dennis waddled back through the gate sheepishly, Big Jim held our bloodhound in his magnificent arms for a very long time. "Cinnamon, come!" I yelled with Big Jim's thunder. Cinnamon held her ground, brave and defiant with her sharp yips, bearing flashes of paper-white teeth. Just before the African painted dog reached her, Cinnamon shot me a look like a deep, knowing smile. She took off in a spirited lunge that catapulted her from the weeds. The one who spits tore after her, fueled by a possession it couldn't name. Cinnamon made it halfway across the patch of grass before the one who spits caught up to her, bringing its frothing jaws down on her tiny body. I couldn't move, couldn't get out of Dennis's grip, couldn't look away. The one who spits held Cinnamon by her neck and shook her, three sharp snaps sideways. And then she was still. The one who spits dropped her ginger body onto the tangled grass, a monstrous seizure assuming control of its head. It bit at nothing in the air and then fell onto its side next to our little fiery friend. The shaking was winning, a hideous tremor, an internal earthquake that would finally conquer its host. Dennis, with me still in his mouth, his slimy, soft jowls blanketing my body, left the townhouse and our partner and the one who spits by taking off down Finney Avenue. The sky, perhaps also in mourning for our little friend, released its promised rain, thick sheets of cloudburst that felt like heartbreak. We were drenched by the downpour. Dennis was walking now, a slow, plodding amble until we were a good distance from the townhouse. I couldn't tell you how long the walk was or what we passed. The one who keeps had been broken with pain and frustration, drowning in disappointment. Our mission felt fruitless, too big to accomplish. After everything we'd done, we'd only saved two pointers and a thuggish common house sparrow. A wild bird. And now the puppies would die because I was inept. I was weak and disabled, unsuitable to take on such a big task. I hadn't saved our beautiful friend. It felt like a cosmic joke. Dennis eventually sat us under a stand of western red cedars, dropping me gently onto a pile of damp moss. The cedars were silent, and I wanted to scream at them. Hadn't they led us here? Hadn't the trees all made me believe this was the right path? And now, when it actually mattered, when I needed guidance, they were audaciously unspeaking, drinking in the rains and taking care of only themselves. I could barely breathe, anger and frustration and pain squeezing my arteries, choking me from the inside out. The world was too difficult, too painful. Without the mofos to keep it in check, rabies would be spreading through the natural world, foaming at the mouth and spilling into their systems through a bite, reducing animals to violence and seizures, to utter madness. The one who spits couldn't be just that African wild dog. It had to be the name those idiot birds of Aura had given to the collective, to all the animals caged in the grips of the disease. I shuddered to think of how many there might be. Dennis lay on the ground with his head on his paws. Rain soaked him to the skin despite the shade from the red cedar. Dennis had known it was over before I had. Perhaps with his umwelt, the incredible stories his nose tells him, he saw some of this coming. He had saved me from my own stupidity, my plucky idiot self. His breathing was heavy, the black tide crashing in around him, but there was nothing I could do. And for the first time, I knew exactly what he was feeling. I missed Cinnamon. The guilt of not being able to save her like a plastic bag on my face. The end had been fast, and she hadn't suffered and become the one who spits, but there was little comfort in that. And then a tidal wave crashed into me without warning. How much I missed Big Jim. I had been waggish and upbeat, and I'd believed the best in everything, and it had gotten me nowhere. I missed how Big Jim took care of me and knew my favorite treasures and how he'd tell me all the things that were on his beautiful mind.
I missed how proud of me he was when he took me to the local bars or Wings of the World, where everyone else had parrots and cockatiels, but he had a motherfucking crow who'd do anything for him, and that got him a lot of respect. I missed how when he'd almost reached the end of a bottle, he'd tell me how much I meant to him, how special I was, how Dennis and I were the only ones he could talk to. I missed Big Jim, and I missed feeling the wind in my wings. The black tide swallowed me up, drenching me in sadness, its undertow dragging me down further than I'd ever been. Things couldn't get any worse. But then I realized that was a particularly idiotic thing to suggest, because they suddenly did get worse, as I raised my drenched head and realized that Dennis and I were surrounded. Chapter 21. Angus, Highland Cow, Strathpeffer, Scotland.
Where the hell is my human? I haven't seen her in weeks. At first I thought it was a wee joke, a wee prank on old Angus, but sure as I shit grass, it's been absolutely ages. I've been standing alone in this bastard field for days. Who's going to bring me my alfalfa cubes? My welly-wearing human, that's who. Soon as she bloody remembers. Poor old Angus out here in the countryside, waiting and waiting like some sort of ginger-haired poultice. All right. I suppose I'm not totally alone. I'm stuck here on these boring, rolling green hills with Nubbins the donkey. The weather is absolute shite. I'm bored out of my mind. I'm so bored I've taken to making up wee songs and poems. Here's a cracker. Again, again, again with the rain. I hate the rain. Pitter-patter, shitty-shatter. Where are my alfalfa cubes, you walloping twonk? Nubbins can't do poetry or songs. Nubbins is too busy rolling around in his own shite. I'm a prized Highland cow. Nubbins is a rescued donkey with a mind like melted haggis, surely destined to be a wee glue pot. Oh, I shouldn't be so rude. He's a wee bit traumatized, our Nubbins. Yesterday he said he'd seen Farmer Stewart in his jammies chasing a sheep that was wearing a biometric collar. Jings, I told him to stop eating thistles. It's frazzling what's left of his wee pea brain. I stuck my head under the fence to ask Hamish about this whole Farmer Stewart gossip. Hamish is a Hebridean sheep, a black wee jobby. Hamish says that he heard Gregor the Goose telling Esme, a Scots dumpy hen who sticks her beak in everyone's business, that he saw Farmer Stewart staggering around the dog kennels the other day. Said he was blutered. His eyes were bright red. Who knows what the truth is? You can't trust a black sheep. So, Nubbins, that numpty, is going bonkers, and I'm bored of the green hillside and the rain, and the rabbits are absolutely out of control. They bonk day and night, and now there are thousands of the wee bastards. I try to send the foxes after them, but you know foxes, what like are they? Bunch of absolute arseholes, can't be trusted. Have you heard them at night? Bloody banshees! I told Nubbins to have a wee word with Margaret. A Highland heifer I've had my beady eye on. I plan to approach her myself when I've figured out what to say. Margaret is an absolute ginger goddess. Udder like a bloody bagpipe filled with custard. Oh, I mustn't get too excited. So, Nubbins goes up to the electric fence, right up to Margaret in the next field, and he's there for ages, and I'm giving him the eye like, "Come on, Nubbins, you giant pillock!" And eventually he comes back with his stupid story about how Margaret's wee pal Shelley, the Shetland pony, told Margaret, the super sexy Highland cow, that all the human farmers have been crawling on top of the barn in town, smashing their noggins on the roof to get inside where all the agricultural robots are. What a load of gossip for the gullible. If humans wanted inside the barn, they could just open the door, for Christ's sakes. Nubbins is a nutjob. He still believes in the Loch Ness Monster. It's all those sweetie wrappers he's been eating. My human will be here soon to trim my toes, sure of it. Angus the Ginger Cow is an overall champion at the Royal Highland Show, and he's got glamour standards to uphold, for God's sakes. She's probably down at the pub, or at a horse show. Do you think she's gone away on holiday without me? Aye, maybe Blackpool. Oh, no, she's probably stuck in the queue at Marks and Spencer. Ah, it's absolutely mobbed this time of year. She'd better hurry up before a Nubbins chokes on a discarded can of Erinbrew, that scabby wee fart lozenge. Eh? What's that, Nubbins? Och, he's mumbling again, that silly wee boot. He's saying the electric fence is off and we're free to go for a wee wander. What a load of tosh. Full of absolute fantasy, that Nubbins.
Chapter 22. ST. Up Shit Creek, Seattle, Washington, USA. The rain pummeled down, spitting and weeping in cool sheets. An assload of fuliginous, unblinking eyes watched us from the branches of red cedars. We were besieged, winged beings outnumbering us. I looked up at their glares, the anticipatory judgment that rained down on me from above. My heart started to race. A fluttering from a high branch caught my eye. A beautiful bird, resplendent with an opalescent sheen, glided down from a red cedar, dropping to the earth near my patch of moss. His contour and facial feathers were elevated, a sign of his breezy dominance. It was Cry, the head cheese of the UW Bothell murder.
"You are injured," he said, spreading his magnificent pinions, water drops releasing like tiny crystals.
"No shit."
"Times have been tough for you," he said.
What is this? You're gonna fly down from your high branch and just start stating the obvious? Thanks, dickwad. You can take your blatant observations and your annoyingly flawless feathers and functioning wings somewhere else.
A smattering of crows caught out. They weren't happy with how I was speaking to their beloved brother. The beautiful crow raised his head up to the sky, raindrops running down the length of his onyx beak.
"You are rescuing the domestics. That's why you were searching for the one who opens doors."
This guy was just all about wounds and salt. And he was really ruffling my feathers. Not that it's any of your damn business, but I got bad intel from the farce that is Aura, and your stupid kind harassed me at the zoo, so I nearly got snarfed by a tiger.
"They are our kind, but the zoo crows are not part of our murder. You shouldn't just lump us all together like that. We are all individuals. Even our murders have their own characteristics. I'm sure there were humans that you didn't like."
"No one comes to mind," I lied. "Why don't you just leave me alone?"
"Because we look after our kind. That is part of what it means to be a crow, a code of murder."
We both looked at Dennis, now a wet rolled rug under the trees. Dennis was my murder. A memory surging like a jolt of electricity hit me. It had been the first thing Cry had inquired about when I met him by the university library. He had wanted to know about my control over the dog. It was Dennis he was interested in, and I swore right then on the whole of my cash collection that he would never have him. "I'm not your kind. I want nothing to do with you and your sky-squatting, bitch-beaked ways. I am not a crow. I'm a mofo." As my words bounced off the rusty trunks of the old cedars, the corvid lungs in the trees gasped.
"But you are a crow. It is known."
Cry cocked his head. No, he would not take away the last good thing Big Jim ever said to me.
"Shit turd, you're one crazy mofo."
Those were my words, my last piece of Big Jim to keep forever. "Stop telling me who I am and invading my space. Get the hell away from us," I shrieked, feeling something inside me rising, boiling like stew.
"The humans are dying out because they upset the natural order of balance. You must accept this. You must return to your roots."
"It isn't true, and I don't have to accept a fucking cracker of what you say. You're a bunch of idiots who think you know everything, and you're wrong. I know they are still out there. You can't claim to know for sure."
"We know through Aura."
"Aura is nothing but spam. A network of totally unreliable fabrications, no better than the National Enquirer. The mofos will survive this."
"Blackwing, the humans were a plague on the Earth. They were not able to control their numbers or their consumption of the land, and so nature did it for them. She is not kind. She is balanced. The one who hollows as well must return. It is known. For every species, there is a calling to evolve, an opportunity for change to ensure survival.
If a species misses the calling to evolve, they are destined for extinction. This is the law of the Earth. I know that deep down you believe this. We have lived side by side happily with humans as their aerial allies, and now we must thrive without them. Surely you do not miss those treacherous... Mofos are treacherous? What about nature? What about the orca who catapults a seal 40 feet into the air just for the hell of it? Or when an assassin bug wears the corpse of its victim for camouflage? Or when a baboon eats its young? That's savagery. Mofos are kind and resourceful and clever and unparalleled in their ingenuity. Masters of creativity. You don't know what you're talking about. I am a mofo. A cacophony of complaint came from the branches, the brassy song of angered crows. Cry held on to his patience like a top-tier canopy branch. Perhaps the truth is that the part of you that's smart and resourceful is the crow part. We're smarter than you give us credit for. You are bird-brained and simple compared to the mofos, I spat. How many of us can recognize a human face, even with a mask on, or when they try to disguise themselves? We all can! We all can! Came unanimous squawking from the trees. He continued, Our children's children know to heed the warnings of an enemy. And how many humans can recognize an individual crow? His eyes were hypnotic and shiny. I thought of how once, after I'd gone to stretch my wings around the neighborhood, I returned to catch Big Jim squawking at a college crow with a white streak on her wing, agitatedly beckoning her from our Green Mountain sugar maple. He called her shit turd, yelling for her to hurry up and sit on his shoulder because he was late for beer pong. She was molting, half my size, had a sebaceous cyst the size of a jawbreaker sticking out of her breast. It had been a serious blow to the old self-esteem. Cry continued, How many of us do you see crumpled roadside like the squirrels and raccoons? None! None! Cried the avian audience. We are soaring shadows, adapting on the wing. We are everywhere on this big, beautiful blue, and that is the privilege of being a crow, Blackwing. We are not caged, never confined to bars and walls. We build tools and communities and use our mind maps to navigate the world, so much easier now without the electro-smog blurring our flight paths. And we are survivors. We thrived in the hollowing time of trash and plastic, and we will thrive in the new world as nature settles her debts. It's time to take what is ours. The crows cawed in agreement. I am not like you. The steaming bubbles inside me were rising. You can't run from who you are, Blackwing. If you try, you will always suffer. Kiss my cloaca! You are a crow. It is your privilege. Get away from me! Counterintuitively, I hopped toward him, rain streaming down my face. You may have been close to a mofo, and I can understand that, but they did not heed the warnings and are suffering the consequences. Your human is gone, and now you must move on. It is time. He'd gone too far. He could smack talk about me and his idiotic theories, but he couldn't make a single squawk about Big Jim. I wouldn't let him. You're right. It is time, I seethed through my beak. Time for me to knock him off his high branch. I snapped, lunging into the air, a strangled caw released with some of the heat inside me. My feet came down on Cry's chest, pinning him to the earth. The cedars broke out into ferocious alarm calls, crows screaming into the rain. Cry cried out, flapping with great strength to push me off him, but my assault had just begun, and I struck at him with my beak. He blocked it with his, lifting into the air. I jumped up, body-checking him, sending him mudbound, hurtling into tumbles. Then I pounced on him, and we were a mass of wings and beaks and feet, strained, screaming, and darting. Jabbing movements. Cry gave one fierce whip of his wings, shoving me off him with a thrusting kick. He lifted again, striving to get away, but I wouldn't allow it. I snatched at him, clawed at him, strange sounds flying from me. My feet found his, locking them tightly in my grip. He lifted me into the air with him. We spun, airborne, bound and battling, a hurricane of black feather and burning heart. We lifted higher, our screeching tearing up the sky, wings shredding the air. Dennis's thunderous barks rose to us as he bayed up to where I squabbled with a crow stronger, fitter, and faster than me. Better than me. Some dark urge from deep inside me had taken control, driving my beak forward toward the crow's eye, aiming to plunge it right into his brain. Cry blocked me with his beak. He might have been better than me, but I had passion on my side, a fury that gave me the strength to wallop him with a sharp kick. And then I tumbled from the sky. I plunged down the length of the cedars, a fall I knew would kill me. My nictitating membrane shut out the world, cocooning it into milky blue, and I held a memory that would be my last. Dennis and Big Jim and me dancing around our green mountain sugar maple, laughing as dandelion fluff snowed around us. I fell down, down, down. I must have been a branch's stretch away from the soil when the sharpness dug into my skin. My fall slowed, and for a moment I was weightless. I opened my eyes, finding myself slumped in a mud puddle, my legs sticking up in the air. Above me, four college crows hovered. I felt the breeze from their wings, the rain sliding off their shiny bodies. Satisfied they had broken my fall, the crows shot to the sky. I caught a glimpse of Cry, cresting the canopy of the cedars, a magnificent ink blot on a paper of gray sky. He vanished. A swarm of oscillating black specks, like a great gust of ground pepper, followed. As they departed, Dennis held his nose to the sky and whimpered. I righted myself. I was soaked, drenched from the rain and the puddle, but mostly in hot humiliation. I had lost the fight and had to be rescued. The rain stopped abruptly, just in time for a wave of shame to crash into me. Never had I felt so small or stupid, so utterly defective. And the worst part of it? I had started it. I had launched myself at him, feral, desperately wild and savage. An animal. Dennis was still sniffing the sky. The residue of rain dripped off branches and hardy leaves. A carpet of moss and mud stretched out around me, lime green and glowing with satiety. Gray, shaggy parasol mushrooms sat with proud postures, slick and shiny. A few leopard slugs inched their way across the earth, leaving a silvery train, evidence of a great journey and adventurous living in their wake. Pastel pink earthworms writhed joyously, having waited for the rains to commence travel. They breathed through their moistened skin. We were still in the city, but somewhere under a grove of cedars where the forest was teeming and ready to rain. There was a break in the clouds, audacious sun rays glowing through the gaps in lime-green leaves. Electric green ferns and spongy moss hugged copper-brown bark and soil. A hermit thrush, freckles decorating his breast, raised and lowered his tail. He let out a powerful flute-like trilling. It was a chirruping aria about strength and resilience, something he had learned from his father and practiced immeasurably. A song that had been passed down his long line of avian ancestors until it was utter perfection in pitch and resonance. It was hauntingly beautiful, tight notes piping up to the sun, shattering the ultraviolet light into a prism of dancing rainbows. I realized, wet and defeated in a puddle of mud, that I was surrounded by devastatingly beautiful things. None of it called attention to itself. No preening and crowing here. Everything just was what it was, intricately complex and simply stunning. This was what was happening to the world, this bewitching woodsy scene that sighed creaks, croaks, and willowy whistles was a preview of oncoming attractions. Peering down at the mud puddle, I saw the waggish, saucy countenance of a crow reflected back at me. A bird with quizzical espresso eyes and twitchy head bobs that, much like the leopard slugs and the earthworms, had been on a great adventure. A bird who had survived a mass extinction, a grizzly bear attack, a python's muscular strike, the jaws of a tiger. A bird who had a heart that had been broken again and again, but that had refused to stop beating. A crow who was seeking. In seeking for life and meaning and a return to balance, perhaps I had been blind to the truth about who stares back at me from the ripples of a murky puddle. It was a crow. In wanting to be like a mofo, why did I have to deny the part of me that was crow? Perhaps Cry was right. Perhaps nature was balancing. And if you cannot evolve, you cannot survive. That is nature's way. I had to be honest with myself and admit that, damn it, I'd always known this. As well as I knew when a storm was coming, or the speed of an oncoming car, or when Big Jim was going to shit the bed because he'd had too much sriracha. It was madness to think that I could take on saving the domestics alone. Just me and Dennis and our poor little Cinnamon? It was a suicide mission. Hadn't I always been the one to harp on the importance of murder? Of family? The Cedars are not just one thing. They are many things. Food, homes, protection, life-givers, communicators. Maybe it was time to get real and realize I could never sprout 10 fingers and be just like a mofo. Perhaps it was time to stop turning my back on my roots. I had been wrong. And lying in a gross puddle with the heart-stopping beauty of our world all around me was like an alarm clock's call, the brassy crowing of a rooster at dawn. I had to change and evolve, or I would become extinct. Even Dennis knew it. I could see it in him as he sniffed at the sky, wishing the crows had stayed. Hadn't I admired Cry? So what if he wanted to learn about how I could create a relationship with a dog? He wanted to share that knowledge with his family for their survival. He saw evolution, intelligence, and ingenuity, perhaps my mofo influence, or perhaps entirely the crow in me. Rejecting a part of myself had been rejecting all of myself in a world where you needed to believe in yourself to survive. If I could open my eyes and see the beauty in every sapling and shimmery dewdrop around me, and I could see the beauty in Cry, perhaps I could also see the beauty in the spunky, twitchy scrutiny that postured back at me from the surface of a puddle. Maybe what really mattered was what was on the inside, as was the case with Big Jim's refrigerator. Change had overtaken our entire world, and now it was my turn. It was time to be a crow. The only thing I'd hurt during the fight with Cry was my pride, so I shook off the mud and resentment and waddled over to Dennis. I hopped onto his back and apologized. I told him I was going to be more open, less judgmental. Because for Twinkie's sakes, Dennis and I deserved not only to survive, but to blossom and flourish. Big Jim would have wanted it, would have been cheerleading for his boys from the sidelines. Dennis, in classic Dennis style, had already forgiven me. He shook off a waterfall of damp and slobber, ears like maxi pads in a hurricane, and put his nose to the business of tracking down a murder of crows who would hopefully do the same.